Every project, big and small, generates data. And efficiencies can be made all throughout a project's life, from design to construction, right through to operation, if the data is captured, analysed and effectively used. HS2 is one of the most complex and challenging railway initiatives the UK has ever undertaken, and it has been generating vast amounts of data. Every geological survey, every station design, every construction site, every environmental survey, all generating more and more data. And since the very beginning, HS2 has been using this to build more and more detailed models that can provide greater insights into the construction and the process as it's going on.
And I think the important bit is to understand that nowadays, virtually any human activity is related to or has some data associated to it. So there's data everywhere. When you wake up in the morning and you move around and you go out to work or you do whatever you do. So it's understanding that, yeah, when you design, when you build, when you plan, there's also data that you need to use.
Hello, I'm Rhian Owen, and welcome to the HS2 Learning Legacy podcast. In this five-part mini-series on HS2's Learning Legacy programme, we've been looking at the lessons engineers and others have learned as they work on the project. HS2 is the largest construction project in Britain, with around 30,000 jobs supported by the project and over 3,200 UK-based businesses helping to build it. Not only will HS2 provide better journeys and boost economic growth, the construction of the project will leave a legacy of knowledge and innovation for the wider industry to learn from. In this final episode, we are unravelling the complexities of Building Information Modelling, or BIM. We uncover how BIM isn't just about constructing buildings, but revolutionising how we manage built assets, setting the stage for a new era of innovation. We've just heard from Roberto Alberola, Head of BIM and Digital for TYPSA, a design company that has been working on HS2 since 2016. Roberto, along with Peter Ruff, Head of BIM at SCS, authored the Towards a Digital Blueprint, Data, Technology and Collaboration at the core of the HS2 Learning Legacy paper. From the early days of the HS2 project, Roberto and Peter have been helping to create a digital model of the entire project using BIM.
So, although it says building information modeling, it's not so much only about buildings, it's about constructing, it's about managing built assets, not necessarily buildings. I think for me, the most interesting part is the methodology side of BIM. So at the end, BIM is the methodology of essentially doing the same thing we've been doing for a long time, but in a different way, with a different method. So basically, it's understanding that a project is not based on documents, it's more based on data. It's more based on information. It's about having all the information related to that project connected to each other and being consistent. And when we say model, it's not only the 3D model side of it, it's also the virtual representation of the built asset and how the performance can be analyzed before it's built.
When Roberto and Peter joined the project, there was already an overwhelming amount of data to work from.
You know, there was lots of items that had been collected previously, like, for example, all the borehole information, which is important if you're doing tunnelling and important if you're doing anything geotechnical. Survey information around the line, that could be, you know, there was topo surveys, point clouds and the like. Existing assets. At least down here in London, we're kind of trying to put a line into existing, basically put something straight into London infrastructure, which is difficult. It's very brownfield. There's lots of existing assets and interfaces with like Network Rail and London Underground and TfL. So we had a lot of asset information coming from those guys. Lots of utilities as well. You have to think about where all the existing mains are and stuff like that to make sure that your design complies with that. So there's a huge amount of existing information which was given to us at the beginning of the project.
Up and down the length of HS2, there are different designers and contractors, and it was the job of the digital team to make sure everyone was on the same page.
So it's all, at the end, it's all around data. It's how we pull data and how we move data between systems from one place to the other to serve the purpose of each one of the teams. There are many, many teams involved working at the same time, each one in their own developing their own scope, let's say, but they're pulling from the same source of data.
Having one single point of truth or a common data environment allows everyone to work from and analyze the latest version of designs. And this is particularly important for a project the scale of HS2, which is dealing with over 7 million points of data.
So not having people wasting time looking for stuff, is this updated? Is this the latest one? So now we have a system that tells you this is the latest one, or if there's anything later. Access information, how to coordinate, how to collaborate one team again with other, using the same data, the same information for all of them.
Ensuring everyone is working from the latest designs can create big efficiency savings, especially as these designs can then be tested digitally for compliance.
So you can ensure that the solution that you're designing is compliant, how to do those checks, all the consistency of information that also saves a lot of time. The idea of pre-constructing before constructing, of, as I was saying, simulating or analyzing the performance of an asset before it's built. That saves a lot of program because it highlights maybe the construction sequence could be done in a different way, improved. That saves time and saves money, of course. Also, the mistakes or errors that we may find when we're building something, if you highlight them beforehand when you have the chance to design it differently or to build it differently with different methods, that also saves time.
When the government first agreed to HS2, the Department for Transport set a target for the digital team that £500 million would be saved on the cost of the project through digital modelling.
It was a number that was set by HS2 when they were talking to DfT. It was an ambitious target, I would say, but it's probably quite light, actually, when you consider what efficiencies could be achieved. In terms of the project itself, the biggest ones would actually be probably just the use of like your common data environment to surface up information in a consistent manner. That is worth a huge amount of money in terms of efficiencies of staff, accessing stuff, not making mistakes, which is a big one, not making errors and not having to do rework and stuff like that.
But HS2 has taken it further than what was initially required through discussions with DfT. It has developed the 5D plus concept of BIM.
Essentially, the extra Ds are when we just add extra processes essentially into that modelling aspect that we spoke about. So with 4D, that's about the time aspect. So that's about when you simulate or virtually construct things before they actually occur. For me, working in construction, it's a very powerful tool to de-risk the build.
This approach allows the team to design complex plans that can be tested and proven out before construction begins. But the digital team wanted more information, so they added a 5D. The 5D accounts for the cost implications of a project.
The 5D was it's got different connotations, but the way that we approached it on this job is more about improving how we estimate and how we cost jobs.
But again, the HS2 digital team wanted to go beyond just cost estimations, so they created 5D Plus.
During that, we kind of coined the 5D Plus, which was about doing our carbon at the same time. Because we know that from an environmental point of view, it's definitely a big deal to HS2, and it's a big deal to the government in general. And we've got quite robust carbon targets on the project. So again, we kind of worked out that when you were working out costs and quantities, you can work out your carbon pretty much quite effectively at the same time. We got involved in what's called early contractor involvement, so ECI. And I've always said that actually is really, really good from a digital point of view, because it allowed us to kind of work in concert with the designers up front to set things up in a very, in quite a mature way, I would suggest. So I definitely would recommend to anyone looking into doing one of these again. ECI is, I found it very, very helpful.
And the digital team was set up in a way to maximise collaboration with contractors across the project.
In terms of our teams, actually, I mean, we took the approach of having a combined team, which was quite novel at the time, I would suggest. So we just had kind of a BIM team. It was made up of individuals from all of the parties involved, actually. And I think that also led to some, hopefully, good efficiencies, I would suggest, and quite a good team bond.
early contractor involvement gave the digital team, designers and contractors a head start on getting their plans ready for construction. But before any of that could begin, there was already vast amounts of geological surveying and earthworks that needed to be done. Across the length of Phase 1, 21 million cubic metres of earth, or 8,400 Olympic-sized swimming pools worth of material, needed to be moved. With a commitment to reduce carbon emissions by 50%, and the earthworks identified as one of the largest sources of carbon emissions, the earthworks team looked to find a new approach that could cut their emissions, cost and time. Determining what the ground is going to consist of before you dig it up is no easy task, and even getting an estimate of the ground material takes decades of experience.
It's kind of very subjective, and I think the key is it actually requires quite a lot of experience sometimes. And a kind of big project, it takes a lot of experienced people to do it, which is time consuming and costly. And it's, as you say, it's the best estimate. It's quite a qualitative assessment in the past. And it was on kind of that expert judgment, in inverted commas, that we would use. So it was good and it served a purpose, but it wasn't quantitative, was it? It was very much kind of finger in the air almost. And those fingers in the air were probably pretty close to reality, but it was quite a time consuming process.
Yeah. When you get into a job, first thing we ask is, do you have enough material to build? And to do that, we will be looking at the geometry of the cuttings and then try to assess. I have to say it's a bit of a guess. Some people will say geological, I say, oh, maybe this one represents 80%. Another one might say, no, for me it's 60%. And then after you put the geotechnical data in front of it and assess in regard to the specification, what can and what can't be used, that takes a lot of time and needs a lot of interpretation.
Johnny Neville is a senior engineering geologist and Ida Rouse Mutar is a geotechnical engineer with joint contractor BBV. They are part of the team who wrote the Driving Efficiency and Sustainability in Material Reuse through GeoBIM Learning Legacy paper. Understanding what material is beneath your feet before you start excavating is important for two reasons. Firstly, to understand how easy it will be to excavate and remove the material from site. And secondly, to assess the potential for reusing the excavated material. HS2 is a project in material deficit. This means it needs more material for fill than they will excavate from cuttings. So using the material they excavate as efficiently as possible provides important cost, material, environmental and time savings.
Really simply, when it's above existing ground, we need to put some fill on top of it to get to that level. And that would be our fill that we need to put something. And then anything below ground is cut and we're excavating. And essentially, we're trying to balance that. So anything that's either below ground is a cut or a tunnel, that will be material that we will have to place somewhere else.
So instead of simply going in and starting the earthworks, Johnny wanted there to be a detailed plan of how the earthworks would be done. First, they chose the earthwork sites that they suspected would have the most complex geology to do further assessment.
We select them based on the geological complexity of this cutting. For when it's simple, we have one or two geologies and it's relatively flat, no difficult geology features, it's easy. You don't need to do a very complicated thing to get your assessment. But we had some serious areas where it has been complicated and guessing was not permitted. That's why we went through that route.
They chose two sites to trial the new 3D GeoBIM model. These sites then had additional data collected to be fed into a 3D geological model, which consisted of topography data, ground investigation data, and the design models. To conduct the ground investigation surveys, they had to decide on a level of detail required, which was dependent on the geological complexity. One of those sites with complex geology is the Offchurch cutting, which required 1 million cubic metres of excavation and was a complicated mix of Mercia mudstone, rock, glacial deposits and soil.
What we identified through the modelling was that there was 10% more glacial deposits than we initially were predicting, and 10% more glacial deposits from 1 million is 100,000 cubic metres. And now glacial deposits It was either glacial deposits or Mercia mudstone. So it's 10% more glacial deposits than otherwise would have been Mercia mudstone.
Knowing what material you will be excavating before earthworks begin allows you to plan what you will do with the material. Every material is classified using the UK Specification for Civil Engineering Works, Series 600.
It's quite simple data. It's plasticity data, it's moisture content data, it's sulfate data. It's data that Mutar is very familiar with, and any contractor is, right? And I think anyone involved in geotechnics, these are kind of almost, they're classified as index tests, a lot of these things. And so you're literally just identifying the base characteristics. We capture this and we report it, and that's reported in AGS format. And so we've got that in a nice digital format that's kind of can be used downstream quite nicely. So in terms of the source data, there's nothing new there. I think the bit we're adding on to it is that 3D visualization aspect.
Investigating ground materials and conditions is all standard as part of earthworks, but HS2's 3D model allows the earthworks team to know not just what the material is, but precisely where it is located.
So before we had the data, and we were probably using it to create statistical models and understand statistically that you have, let's say, 70% of your cutting, you might know is a class 2 material, but what you would not know is where that 70% of that material is. So what's very hard is kind of, you might have 70% that's class 2, but if it's all mixed in and it's all mixed together, you're not actually going to be able to separate it out.
All this data on the materials in the ground as well as the 3D model shows exactly where the deposits are. And this model was used to create a plan to excavate and reuse material as efficiently as possible in terms of time, cost, and carbon savings. Mass haulage movements were optimized using the data from the 3D model. Teams undertaking excavation were able to target areas with material that was required for construction taking place nearby. But mass haulage is not the only area where time and carbon can be saved. Huge carbon savings can be found in how you treat the material to make it usable. Class 7 material needs to be lime treated to unlock its potential for construction applications.
Lime has a carbon embodied carbon value of about 4 times higher than other fills, so it's really significant. When you blow it up to the kind of 25 million meters cubed of material that we're going to be moving, if you can save adding lime into even a third of that, the carbon adds up quite quickly.
The site of the Uffchurch cutting was initially assumed to be a mix of Class 2 and Class 7 material, and it would be difficult to extract one from the other.
We initially had planned to lime treat the whole material that would come from that cutting.
But when the 3D spatial assessment was done, it showed that actually the Class 2 and Class 7 materials were separated and could be extracted independently. Despite initially assuming that all of the Uffchurch cutting material would need to be lime treated, the assessment showed that only half of it would need it, resulting in significant carbon savings.
I think that was about 16,000 worth of tons of carbon alone there saved. Now that's only one cutting, so you could start scaling that up across all 30-40 cuttings we've got and get really big numbers. Now of course you're not going to get the savings of that on everyone, but that's the kind of things that were popping out when we did a kind of rough assessment.
But it's not just carbon savings. As Johnny mentioned earlier, the 3D spatial assessment at Uffchurch revealed more than 10% solid glacial deposits than expected.
And the benefit of glacial deposits, as Mutar has kind of suggested, is you can get class one from the sands there, and also it is normally much wetter, so you don't have to add water into it, which can be often as an environmentally and time-consuming process there. So from this particular cutting, I think it was some ridiculous number, like 10 million litres of water that we managed to reduce just because it was glacial deposits, not having to bring more water in to put into the Mercia mudstone.
After the success with the Uffchurch cutting, this technique was implemented across 17 different cuttings with sufficiently complex geology. And so far with optimized mass haulage, enhanced material reuse strategies, and the reduction of lime treatment from 2.5% to 1.5% across those sites, the north section of Phase 1 has had a 50% overall reduction in carbon footprint during the project's earthworks. By embracing new technologies and adopting a data-driven approach, HS2 has not only achieved savings in time, cost and carbon, but also positioned itself as a catalyst for innovation across the UK construction industry. And all that information is being made freely available through the Learning Legacy project.
I think you can forget that we're in this HS2 bubble sometimes, where the amount of innovation that's going on, you just start to think it's just normal. And you can sometimes forget that how innovative some of this stuff is. And so I know from reading some of the technical papers for other aspects of the geotechnical world that are in there, like I've learned a lot, and there's some other fantastic things going around. So just sharing that wider is really important.
I think there's definitely been a lot of lessons learned over the last few years. And again, it's been interesting to kind of be involved for such a long time and see how things have shifted. I think you have to use some of these techniques on big projects. I don't see, for example, with that common data environment, I don't see how you could ever go back on that, especially when you're working with thousands of people. HS2 attracts a lot of international interest. And me and Roberto have spoken to, clients over in Europe, in Australia, in the States, about what HS2 have done, because they're interested in taking some of the lessons learned. And I guess when we had the mantra of the digital blueprint, it was just trying to, I guess, turn the dial a little bit on the projects, you know, make sure that we learn the lessons from maybe other mega infrastructure projects. The founding principles was always to try and, as I said, use the like blueprint and share knowledge. So, you know, and stuff like the Learning Legacy is a great way of doing that.
I mean, it's a good story. We said, okay, there's a good story here. We can tell a good story, and it's good for everyone. It's not for us, it's for everyone to have a good story. Anyone can learn from this, as we've learned.
We would like to wrap up this Learning Legacy series by hearing part of the keynote speech from the first HS2 Learning Legacy live event that took place in October 2023. The event had talks from authors of Learning Legacy papers and was attended by their colleagues and counterparts from across HS2 and the wider industry. The keynote speech was given by Dr. Anne-Marie Mafeiden. Dr. Anne-Marie was the youngest student to pass A-level computing, aged just 11. At 20, she received her master's degree in mathematics and computer science from the University of Oxford. Since then, she has worked in the tech sector, the financial sector, and received honorary doctorates from 8 different universities. But she spends most of her time working on the social initiative she co-founded, STEMX.
We work with young people aged 5 up to 25 to encourage, inform, connect them with the STEM industry, being science, technology, engineering, and maths, but also STEAM, which is science, technology, engineering, arts, and maths. Very important to bring all of them in together. And over the last 10 years, we've worked with more than 60,000 young people.
Thank you for listening to this mini-series on HS2's Learning Legacy programme. Let's close out with some advice that Dr. Anne-Marie gave the audience on how we can all leave a lasting legacy.
So I wanted to close by giving you kind of maybe 5 tips, 5 things that I hold on to, that I hold dear, that have been helpful in leaning into that legacy, creating, curating, and sharing what lessons are learnt, but also being able to reflect and be open to saying, yeah, things have gone wrong. Firstly, is to have a growth mindset. And a growth mindset means that you are constantly stepping just outside of your comfort zone. It means that you want to know more this week than you knew last week, and more this month than you knew last month, more this year than you knew last year. It's a really interesting and easy one, perhaps, to do on the technical side. Of course, there's always a new version, right? There's always a new iteration, there's always something else, but how can we do that in terms of the learning and the understanding of our folks, of our impact, of our legacy? And from this platform, this gift of a platform that you have, how are you going to ensure that actually over time, I want to keep stepping just outside of my comfort zone. I want to keep doing things that are slightly difficult, and I want to keep noting down what those lessons are to have been learnt. So having a growth mindset means you step just outside your comfort zone, because that's where the magic happens in those lessons. Secondly, is to be experimental. This idea of experimentation and constantly being in a loop of experimentation has set me and others that I know who are constantly learning lessons up in good stead. It means that everything is an experiment. You're always building, measuring, learning, and then coming back again. You're always open. When it's an experiment, you have an hypothesis. You don't know if it's right or if it's wrong. If you do know, then it's not an experiment, sorry, right? But we're setting it up and we're saying, okay, cool, we're gonna come back, we're gonna reflect on it, we're gonna learn. And we're gonna go from making very simple mistakes to making really high quality mistakes. We don't continue to make the same mistakes. We make new mistakes and we really do further knowledge in a way that's incredibly powerful. But also for you as a manager, as a leader, for you as a grad or someone else that's coming up, being able to be in that series of experimentation is also going to set you up to really take advantage of all the new exciting things that come as we hurtle towards the future. Third is to be intentionally inclusive always, otherwise you're unintentionally exclusive. There are lessons to be learnt in all corners, from all manner of folks, from all manner of perspectives. It's not just the principal, it's not just the person that already knew everything. There are small micro lessons, there are macro lessons. Second to last is that the visibility of our lessons matters, and it takes a lot of courage. Right? Courage that can be reinforced by the right kind of culture, which I believe that you might have by the presence of this platform, but actually getting comfortable with noting these things down, sharing them, talking them through, building on them is a big part of it. We have failure parties in my team. Quarterly. Hey, everyone, what's something that went wrong this quarter? Let's talk about it. And then finally, there's something in recognizing the sphere of influence that you do have, not just in a platform like this, but in the way that you do projects, the way that you engineer, the way that you lead, the way that you collaborate with others around those lessons that are learnt. So recognize and use that influence. You owning up to something, you being able to share, you resharing and building based on the lesson that's come from someone else. There's something magical actually in being able to do that.
I've been your host, Rian Owen. Thanks to our guests, Roberto Alberello, Peter Ruff, Johnny Neville, Ida Rasmuta, and Dr. Anne-Maria Mafeiden. You can get more details on the topics featured in this series by taking a look at the HS2 Learning Legacy website. We've provided links in the episode description. To learn more about HS2, go to hs2.org.uk or follow us on social media at HS2LTD. We'll be right back.